Hello, hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily Fringe Show and another week of life in wacky, zany, and wonderful South Africa. I'm joined here today by Mr. Tieko Tsotse. Tieko, how are you doing, man?
I'm doing good, things, and how are you, Nick, sir? Good afternoon, Herman, sir. Good afternoon to
I'm
the viewers.
Good, and apparently, the whole country is freezing cold, except where you are, Tieko, in Limpopo.
Yeah, no. It's hard this side, as always.
We are also joined by Mr. Herman Pretorius. Herman, how are you doing?
I think I'm somewhere between, you know, not just geographically, but in terms of temperature. It's cold, but it's not, you know, taps stop working cold here. So I'm, on that basis, I'm okay. And I also am apologetic for being the reason for the delay in today's show start. So I sincerely apologize.
No worries. So just a couple of things before we get into our stories. The first one is, check out the court action around Jacob Zuma's parole. The IRR is there opposing his medical parole. And we have, I believe we've laid it out on the show before, some very specific arguments about why we think that Jacob Zuma should not have gotten medical parole. And these are, so please support us. Check that out. We're doing some court action there. So Gabriel Krause, our colleague, and our attorneys are there in court today in Bloemfontein. And the other thing is, if you would like the Institute of Race Relations, which of course supports and funds the Daily Friend, to come to your town, your community, to speak about the country, state of the country, the future, what you can do, please send an email to sairrevents@gmail.com. We've already got a couple of those, so I'm very happy for that. We'd love to hear from you, and we'd love to get in touch with you. Anyway, let us move on to the stories of today. The first one is, I think, the big story from Sunday, which caused a little bit of a debate on social media, but has also gotten a lot of people's imaginations running quite wild. And this is, of course, some polling numbers reported in the Afrikaans press. I think it was specifically a report that reported this, that said that the ANC might even be polling nationally below 40% of the vote. Now, it's obviously very far out from 2024. There's a lot of time to go. There's a lot of an election campaign to still have. Who knows where it's going to go from here on out. But Herman, you've been looking quite closely at some of these polls. What do you make of, firstly, that poll, and what do you make of some of the other ones and the responses to it?
So I think the first thing that about this polling that was covered in the report, and I think also perhaps the City Press, I can't remember the corresponding English newspaper, the numbers are intriguing, absolutely, but the reporting is quite silent on the methodology used. So one is always cautious about endorsing a poll or setting too much stock by a poll when you're not quite clear on the methodology. The interesting thing about the report piece is that it actually, in a way, references two polls. And on the one set of polls, you've got this sort of the DA on 27%, you've got Action SA on 6%, and then sort of in another poll, it seems, the ANC is presented as below 40%, you know, 38-39%. The problem is that I don't want to cast aspersions on the integrity of the poll or the journalist who genuinely, like, he's really, really a fine young journalist in South Africa. Those numbers are, I think, for people opposed to the ANC, overly optimistic. It's not clear what the source of the very, very low ANC polling numbers are. Some people are saying that it's ANC poll numbers. I couldn't verify that. I've tried to speak to people to understand where this poll might be coming from within the ANC. And one of the responses I got was that the ANC is so in disarray that they can't even get this basic idea of opinion polling to be completely coherent and functional. So if it's an ANC poll, they are very likely flawed in terms of execution. And if it is an ANC poll, there's a possibility that the rest of the party might not know it. There are a few polls now in the mix. This morning, we've seen a new poll by Ipsos Mori covered in the Daily Maverick. So by my count, we're looking at three semi-published polls. We've got the Ipsos Mori one, we've got the one that puts the ANC very low, and then we've got the one that places the DA on 27, Action SA on 6%. Now, I have seen a private polling that is yet to be published by people I think have a good grasp of methodology to say that I think these are overly optimistic estimations. I don't think the DA is as high as 27%, but it isn't. They've come a long way from the very low, high teen polling that we saw in 2019, October, November specifically. So there's clearly some recovery, but 27 is very, very high for the DA. Action SA on 6, quite plausible. If you look at a couple of other polls, you do see Action SA 5 or 6%. Now for a political party,
right, that's really make them. What, fourth largest party in parliament, I think?
It depends on the performance of the IFP. They'll be behind the ANC, DA, and the EFF on those numbers, but they could either be fourth if the IFP has a bad day, or fifth if the IFP has a good day. The IFP is always sort of difficult to predict in performance. But that would be a good showing.
Because their voters tend to not be super connected to sort of the media scape. To reach for pollsters.
Very much so. But the interesting thing, and Action SA has been attacking the IRR a bit. They've rediscovered engaging with me on Twitter, which is not always wonderful. I said that, you know, this is a respectable figure for Action SA, and it is a respectable figure for a party that hasn't run a national election campaign. With no real national campaigning apparatus in place, to be in the mid single digits is decent. I mean, if you think about it, COPE only got to 7% of a result that was after massive public coverage, after significant spending and hype. So the fact is that Action SA at this stage, 630 days away from the election, should be happy with that sort of number. And they shouldn't be so sensitive about the criticism. Well, they shouldn't be so sensitive and take it as criticism. It's not criticism. If it's accurate, build from that. If it's inaccurate, then ignore it. But the idea that this is some sort of an attack by a conglomerate of things, I think, is just silly. Briefly, I'm rambling terribly here, but briefly getting to the Ipsos Mori poll, I think it's worth noting, and Darby Scholtz points this out on Twitter this morning, Ipsos has a tendency to overestimate ANC support and underestimate DA support. So with the Ipsos poll putting the ANC on 42%, that to me is quite low. But if you then take into account appropriate turnout scenarios, you get the ANC closer to 49 on the Ipsos data. That sounds to me believable. 49, just below 50 for the ANC sounds good. However, then they've got the DA on 13 and the EFF on 10, Action SA on 3. These numbers I don't really buy. I've got no fundamental methodological reason.
I'm pretty sure there was an Ipsos poll which had before the last election, had the DA at around 13 and it ended up getting, you know, closer to 20%.
Yes, it ended up breaching 20% in the municipal elections, at least. In the 2019 elections as well. So the thing about polls that I always warn people about, and is a poll isn't magic, it's not a prediction. Polls are at their best when taken as a useful data tool as part of a collective. Polls indicate movement better than absolute positions. You could rather have relative positions and relative readings on the polls rather than absolute readings of these polls. What I would say is the polling industry in South Africa is quite small, young, in so it's got a lot of maturity to go through. But we are seeing a very, very confused picture. And I would take every poll that you get out there that doesn't set out its methodology quite clearly, I would take as a useful indicator of political travel, but not necessarily a hard and fast finding.
So there's a lot to kind of mull about and think about there. Tiego, what do you make of all this? I mean, it seems to me that one of the big takeaways here is that it looks to me as though the ANC is almost certain to get below 50%. I mean, none of these polls, even in the one which models the turnout a little bit better for Ipsos, had them at what, 49, I think Herman said. And there's a couple of parties that could potentially get at least maybe 1 or 2% of the vote, maybe more. Songezo Zibi's party, Makhweng Makhweng's party, I think Musi Maimane's launched a party or something today, who could potentially draw more away from there. What do you make of all this?
Well, I think the story in South Africa is changing. The ANC is most likely gonna, I reckon the ANC is most likely gonna get a percentage below 50%. But honestly, I haven't done any real work to determine this. This really just comes from the polls that one reads online. But more than anything, just interacting with people on the ground, you can tell in the language of the people on the ground when you engage with people on a daily basis, that there is a shift happening in South Africa. You walk into a taxi rank, you go into rural areas, townships, areas where normally people would be supporting the ANC and everything of that nature. The language has begun to change in those areas. One can't exactly measure what they are moving towards, but yeah, they are definitely, people are more and more moving away from the ANC, I reckon. So yeah, we look quite forward to more polls and 2024 elections ultimately, sure.
So another point I just want to ask you about, Tiego, is the EFF. What's quite interesting to me about these polls is that the EFF is sitting around sort of 10% in these polls. And, you know, maybe that's an undercount of their vote, but I doubt it's by that much. What do you make of the EFF's performance? Do you think they've kind of, in a sense, reached a sort of ceiling of about, I don't know, between 10 and 15% of the vote?
I definitely reckon so. I think they've reached the ceiling. If really you... If you go onto the ground, the EFF initially had a lot of support, but the support is surely dying down. You go into township areas where they had strong branches, you go into rural areas where they had strong branches, universities, those branches are slowly but surely dying off. You go onto Twitter, listen to what people are saying about the EFF, the support is dying down. I think more and more people are realizing that Julius Malema is a one-man party, but more than anything, it's run by a dictator, really. And yeah, with this time that we've had to observe the EFF, I think more people are learning and beginning to realize that no, this is not a party that we can entrust to the with the government of the country. So I don't only think that they've reached their ceiling. I think, and this is just speculation, really. No work, no research has been done around this. But I do think their numbers will be dropping come 2024. People who supported them previously are more and more running away from them because of the things that they stand for, things that they say, and stuff of that nature. Sure.
I'm going to briefly just push back against Tiego there. I don't anticipate a fall in the EFF's support numbers, because if you go look at their constituency, that constituency has remained relatively stable, but also the circumstances of that constituency hasn't really changed. People have this idea, and the EFF tried to promote this idea.
Is that true? Because, you know, one of the things I think we've seen in the EFF support is that it's originated was very much in Northwest, in Gauteng, in Limpopo. And then over subsequent elections, it didn't really seem to grow there, but it sort of spread to the rest of the country. And I think in the last election, they didn't actually do that well in Limpopo.
Yes. If you look at the last few elections, 2016, 2019, 2021, the EFF support actually comes not from the rural, poorer areas. It's a typical leftist socialist party in the sense that it is misleadingly suburban.
I think we lost you there for a second. Could you just say again?
Okay, cool. The EFF is an interestingly suburban party, unexpectedly so. Secondly, it is a party that has very, very, very strong brand loyalty just from a marketing perspective. You can test that against any you know, possible set of circumstances. It communicates quite clearly. People can identify an EFF message far better than they can identify an ANC, DA, Action SA, ACDP message. So I see no reason to think that the EFF support is going to go down. I see no reason for it to go spectacularly up. And I've got a theory that the EFF really doesn't want to be in government, that it got the best of both worlds now as, you know, perpetual opposition, getting good salaries, having access to a media platform whenever they want to, without any of the real responsibilities of government. That's a theory, we can look at that later. But I don't think the EFF is likely to go down below 10%, nor up above 13%. Just for the simple reason that EFF voters will have no real reason to shift since the last time they went to the polls.
I think there's a question of illegal immigration, and I think that's a main issue that's going to cause this shift. It's an issue that many of its supporters don't like how they've addressed it, saying that illegal foreigners should just jump into the country, no problem, we are one African, stuff of that nature. I think a lot of its supporters have come out against it around that, but Herman is an expert here. We'll wait for 2024 and see how it goes.
Yeah, I think it's quite interesting actually on that last point, because the EFF, you know, as you say, they have this kind of race solidarity view that, you know, all of Africa should be one country. And then at the same time, they've also recently obviously been a bit spooked by what Tioko is saying. And so they've, remember they did that quote-unquote raid on a restaurant in I think it was Centurion or Midrand or something, where they went to look and make sure there weren't too many foreigners being employed by this restaurant. And they also then at the same time insisted that this wasn't anything to do with sort of xenophobia, and they were just, they were actually helping our African brothers and sisters. So I think they're a little bit confused on this issue. They don't really know what they stand for.
But I do think that's part of why their vote will be stable, is the people who vote EFF aren't really interested in policy. It's more that they are interested in a narrative about what's gone wrong, what's gone right, what's the type of leadership needed. And I do think that one of the key skills or the key criteria for political office is to execute a U-turn with elegance. I mean that Julius Malema can maintain his balance based on the types of turns he will have to do from one day to the next. It's testament to his ability to, I don't know, keep his eye on the ballet mirror or something.
Mm-hmm. Interesting to watch. But yeah, I recommend that if you're interested in how the EFF is doing, keep an eye on their statements about foreigners and then see what they do, because that could suggest how the party itself sees its electoral fortunes. Anyway, let's move on to our next story. And this is a big one that made international news, and that's the famous Indian-born British author Salman Rushdie was stabbed in an attempted assassination I think last week on, I think it was Friday. He was an author who in 1988 wrote a book called The Satanic Verses, which is, I haven't read it myself, but from what I understand of the plot, it's sort of quite a complex novel about these various characters, one of whom is mentally ill. And the mentally ill guy has these visions or these sort of psychotic dreams about interacting with the early Islamic world, particularly with the Prophet Muhammad. And this was seen as quite blasphemous by a lot of Muslims around the world, particularly by the hardline Islamist clerics in Iran. And the supreme leader of Iran in 1989, Khomeini, issued a fatwa that is a sort of religious decree demanding that all righteous and faithful people go and kill Rushdie. So that's obviously quite a long time ago, but Iran has never entirely forgiven him for writing this book. There have been privately raised bounties on his head for years, where sort of paramilitary groups and sort of semi-state apparatuses like the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps and state-controlled media have raised money to pay out to any would-be assassin of Rushdie over the years, and these bounties are still in place. So during a talk about the importance of the US as a place for persecuted artists, Rushdie was attacked by a 24-year-old man who I believe is a Lebanese guy. His surname is Matar, and he apparently, according to his social media posts, was at least a fan of Shiite Islamic extremism and possibly also was in contact with the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps, although there isn't that much evidence yet to suggest that he was directly sort of set up by them. But who knows? Maybe he was. Maybe this is an Iranian-backed plot. Of course, Iran has denied that it had anything to do with the stabbing, although Iranian state media has celebrated the stabbing of Rushdie with enormous amounts of glee. It's also possible that this the would-be assassin was linked to Hezbollah, which is an essentially Iranian proxy in Lebanon. But there's still not too much information on that. But I'm sure stuff will come out in the next few days about, you know, whether this was a lone wolf thing or whether this was a more orchestrated attack. But there's been a lot of reaction from leaders all over the world in horror about this, because it is seen by many as an attack on freedom of speech. Herman, what do you make of all this?
Well, I mean, you've summed it up better than I can. I can't add any factual questions there. I haven't read Rushdie myself. I've tried once. I didn't get far. But I do think this is a very interesting, where we're heading into a very, very interesting time for the, you know, what one might call the West, though that term is, of course, a bit, you know, odd. But liberal democracy based on the idea of universal franchise, and freedom of speech, freedom of association, freedom of religion, these sorts of basic elements that one might consider the conglomerate nations of holding these dear to be the West. It's an interesting situation because we've seen governments in the West take very anti-free speech stances over recent years, increasingly, Canada perhaps being a very, very extreme example of it. So it comes at an interesting time for this champion of free speech to be under immense pressure. Him being under pressure, it comes the West being under pressure because of this attack, being forced to you know, come out in favor of free speech, while at the same time sending people to jail for tweets and having the police turn up to houses for offensive words, and it really just sort of illustrates the schizophrenia of what one might call classical liberalism in the West under the same liberal mantle as progressive liberalism, where people want the one, bits of the one, but not the other. I mean, the idea that J.K. Rowling, some sort of anonymous or small fry Twitter troll, also said to her, "You're next." And the fact that sort of J.K. Rowling, I don't know of any specific incident where she did anything as offensive to the Islamic world as Rushdie, so I've got no idea why she would be next, except if you take into account that she's a TERF. She has come out with a horrible, horrible notion that women are women, biological women are women, and biological men are men. And somehow there's been a reaction in the West against her, trying to quote-unquote cancel her, sort of she's become persona non grata. And this is the same West that now wants to sort of lament the attack on Salman Rushdie as an assault on free speech. I do think that the schizophrenia of this paradigm is really starting to show, and the change will come in some way of this era of history coming to a next chapter.
Well, to be fair, you know, someone getting cancelled, maybe getting fired from their job, getting socially hounded.
Yes, it's not the same.
It's not quite the same as getting stabbed in the head. As far as we know, Rushdie is recovering. He was briefly on a ventilator, but has been since has been taken off it, and it seems to be at least recovering. Although, you know, he's quite an old guy. I think he's in his 70s, and he's apparently, his humor and wit is back, but he's still not obviously in great shape. Tieko, what do you make of all this? This is kind of one of those sort of free speech controversies, I think, from long before we were all adults, because there was a lot written about this in the 90s and the 80s. But it sort of had since gone away. And I think a lot of people are shocked that, you know, this had happened to Rushdie. What do you make of this whole story?
No, I was equally shocked, if not more shocked than that lot of people, that in 2022 someone would stab someone for perhaps the views that they hold around any issue, really. For me, it was very shocking, and it's a real violation of freedom of speech. And everything that Herman has said as well, I think it's quite true, and I stand with. But more than anything, for me, it kind of reminded me of South African townships, whereby you could go chill there on a Friday night, say something, and get stepped, be stepped for that. It has never made sense to me, and yeah, that's why this doesn't make sense to me at all. And yeah, really, that's everything I can say around this.
Indeed. Anyway, the guy accused, Matar, has, worth noting, pleaded not guilty, and we'll have to see what happens in the court to go ahead. All right. And I think let's move on to our final story. And this is a video that's gone viral of a guy being beaten by the cops in the Western Cape. There's a woman who's doing the filming, who's asking the police to stop beating him. He also is apparently asking the police while he's being beaten, "What did I do? Why are you beating me?" It's not entirely clear what the story behind all of this is. And now, I don't think it's, unfortunately, it's not particularly news that a person is being beaten by the police in South Africa. This is not a rare occurrence. We've seen many people not just beaten, but sometimes killed by the police in South Africa completely unjustifiably. However, what's really concerning to me about this is that the Official Community Policing Forum, the CPF, decided to go to the police station where this has happened, where the man is still apparently being held in the holding cells there, to check up on his condition and to sort of investigate the circumstances. And according to them, they were denied access to the premises by the police, and the police on duty refused to take social media posts and video of the incident into evidence, and then ejected the CPF members from the station. There's also apparently now they have laid a complaint with the Independent Police Investigative Director, IPID, to look into the circumstances of this. But Tieko, what do you make of this? No? There you are.
No, I don't know what happened, but I lost you there for a bit. Could you come up with a question again? Let me respond.
Oh, sorry. I was just saying, what do you make of the assault on this guy, and also the refusal to let the CPF investigate the circumstances?
Well, I think it's real madness. At first when I read the story, I thought perhaps the police and the police division, police station where the guy was kept, up to no good. But then I remembered again that we have police in the police force who want to use the power of the police force to who abuse the powers really of the police force, and really want to show us that they are the police, they have this power, they can do anything. And I thought to myself that that's most likely what happened in this incident as well. That really they were just flexing their powers as police more than anything. And that's why the whole thing turned out how it did. I mean, it's a lot of times whereby I've had such situations before, whereby you stumble upon a police officer, and because they're a police officer, they talk to you or treat you in a certain manner simply because they are in the blue uniform and you are wearing your own personal clothes. It's something that really happens in South Africa on a daily basis, whereby the police really, really do abuse their powers. But more than anything, it's disappointing that they did not allow the two community members from the policing forum to come and see the guy and communicate with them. But I rest assure you that it could very well that it's just policemen and women just being arrogant and flexing the power that they have when wearing their work uniform. Sure.
Herman, final thoughts?
Yeah, no, I must say it was sort of odd because I'm now in the aftermath of his death. I'm reading many of the things that JKB wrote, amongst others, of course, his brilliant autobiography. And the reporting over police brutality formed such a fundamental part of apartheid that it is insane that we are still and again facing this sort of thing. But I do think it comes down to four failures. Failure of trust between communities and the police. There's no longer that trust or accountability. Number two, police officers are quite often not well trained. Number three, that's probably because of a combination of the next two factors, and that is civilian oversight by the government is absolutely shocking, of an immensely low quality, and of course a national level, and Mbeki Tele must go. And then the fourth real sad collapse in the police service has been the collapse of the chain of command, is that you no longer have this elegant system where you have escalating possibilities for complaints, for quality assurance. So these four things collapsing, the training, trust and accountability, chain of command, and civilian oversight have really led to this point where the police in South Africa is just, I mean, you can't rely on them for being anything other, sadly, than an exacerbator of injustice or perhaps an instigator of it. And that's a bad expectation. There are some good members, of course, in the police, but there's a systems failure and a systems rot that's it in because of these four questions matters.
Well said. All right, that is unfortunately all the time we have for today. We hope that you enjoyed the show. I think I may have had some connectivity issues there, but anyway, apologies for that. And yeah, I hope that you all have a wonderful week ahead. We'll see you tomorrow on the Daily Friend Show. And cheers, everyone.